reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. Before you begin, Council, I want to introduce students who are here with our Court with Class program. We have students from Edgar High School. Is it Edgar? Would you stand, please? Thank you. It's good seeing you. You may be seated. And we have students from Green Lake High School. Would they stand, please? Oh, we welcome you also, and you may be seated. These students are here with the Wisconsin Supreme Court and State Bar National Award-winning program called Court with Class. And students from all over the state are invited to attend an oral argument, and if they accept this invitation, there's given briefs, and they study this case. And part of that program is to have them meet with a justice of the Supreme Court at noon, thereabouts, when we finish this case, and that justice today will be Justice Prosser. So let me introduce the court to you, and I'll start on the far left, which is Justice Patience Robinsack. Justice Prosser sits next to her. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Diane Sykes. I'll call our next case, which is 02-2490-W, State Ex Rel Ralph A. Is it Cale?
Cale.
Cale. And Jackie Cale versus Circuit Court for Dane County. And at the microphone is Warren R. Fink representing the Cales.
Thank you. So? May it please the court, learned colleagues. How you define the word refuses in this case will have a significant impact on law enforcement and the prosecution of criminal activity in the state of Wisconsin. Under the state's theory of the case, the following scenario certainly becomes possible. A young woman having difficulty with her unpredictable and violent husband tells her parents that she's going out with him one last time to break off their relationship and end their marriage. She tells them he is to bring her back home to her parents by 9 p.m. that evening. He comes to pick her up at the parents' home at the appointed hour, and she is last seen by them driving off with him in his car. 9 p.m. comes and goes. Their daughter does not come home. By midnight, the parents are worried. By 4 the next morning, they are scared and call the police. The police respond. They're given the facts and the husband's name and address. They go to his home where they wake him up. He is alone, calm, and sleepy. He tells the police that he and his wife had a pleasant supper at a local restaurant. They spoke about their relationship and all was well. She told him she wanted to be dropped off at another restaurant where she was to meet some friends. He did not know the friend's name. He dropped her off and came home and has not seen or heard from her since. The police checked the first restaurant, and no one recalls seeing the couple present the night before. No one at the second restaurant recalls seeing the young woman either. The young woman fails to return home, does not appear at her job. All activity on her cell phone, bank accounts, and credit cards ceases. Despite an all-out search by the police of all of her haunts and with all of her friends, flyers posted by the parents, television coverage, the young woman is not to be found. Weeks and months pass, a year, and then another. The woman's body is then discovered in a densely wooded area near the first restaurant where the couple were to have dined when it is cleared for development. She was strangled. No forensic evidence was found linking anyone to her body. The parents are convinced that the abusive husband, who has since taken over the family business in which their daughter had a significant financial interest and cashed in the life insurance that he took out on her, is responsible for the disappearance and death of their daughter. They contact the police and the local district attorney demanding prosecution of the husband. The district attorney tells them he believes that the husband is probably responsible for the disappearance and death of their daughter, and they are just waiting for him to slip up. The district attorney tells them that the husband has the history, motive, and opportunity to have killed their daughter. He tells them he could prosecute, but that a conviction would be difficult to obtain. He hopes the police will continue to keep tabs on the husband and that he will ultimately slip up and reveal evidence that will enable them to prosecute more effectively. The parents consult a lawyer who says there's probable cause to prosecute. The DA has failed to act on that probable cause. A petition under Section 96802 sub 3 is filed. The facts outlined here are presented to the judge. The judge finds probable cause and orders the private criminal complaint to be filed. The DA's hand is revealed. The police investigation is effectively stopped. Because there is no more evidence to be found, the trial proceeds and the husband is acquitted. Because proof beyond a reasonable doubt cannot be provided to the jury. This hypothetical case is what will become real if you define the word refuses as suggested by the State and Judge Finn. If their more open concept of refusal, which would include some period of inactivity by a prosecutor when confronted with a demand for prosecution and sufficient facts to commence that prosecution, if that's allowed, then judges will be thrust into those discretionary calls entrusted to prosecutors and will result in premature prosecutions which spoil investigations. The unhappy and justifiably so emotional families of the disappeared and the unsolved homicide victims will seek justice on their own and unfortunately thwart effective law enforcement. This is the policy call that this Court is being confronted with in this case. And you need to and should limit Section 96802 sub 3 to those rare cases intended by the legislature where a prosecutor is absent or absolutely refuses to file a complaint when one is clearly called for on the facts of the case.
Counsel, let me ask you a couple of questions.
Sure.
To begin with, you seem to be relying on the fact that inactivity is the only reason here why Judge Finn made the decision he made. I don't believe that's quite correct, is it? Isn't there also the testimony of the complainant at the hearing before Judge Finn? And isn't there also the statements made by the assistant district attorney? That's the testimony by the complainant was she had been told, go on, do what you want here. By the district attorney's office, and the statements by Mr. Hansen seem to indicate that they weren't going to take any action.
What Deputy District Attorney Hansen said, Justice Crooks, was that we haven't taken any action yet. It doesn't mean that we won't if presented with a proper referral, but we haven't acted yet. He categorically said that there had not yet been a refusal by his office to prosecute.
He also talked about the ambiguity of the statute.
That's correct.
And he also talked about the fact that the judge could interpret the statute in terms of failure to file as well as in terms of refusal.
And I think that that's an incorrect statement of law. I don't believe that the statute is ambiguous. I don't think refuses encompasses a period of inactivity at all. I think that those gratuitous remarks by Mr. Hansen have no legal effect at all in this case. They're just plain wrong.
Well, let me
address the other part of your question, if I might, which was Ms. Chater's testimony that she thought that she was being, that she was free to do whatever she wanted to do, that they weren't going to do anything. She based that in her testimony on the record on this last letter that she got from a District Attorney Blanchard, which was not part of the original record before Judge Finn when he had the hearing. That letter wasn't introduced until I filed the motion for reconsideration. That letter doesn't say what Ms. Chater claims it did say. So I think that her testimony that she was free to do whatever she wanted to do or that they weren't going to do anything was her interpretation of Mr. Blanchard's letter, which I don't think is a reasonable interpretation at all.
Well, she probably was zeroing in on the line in the letter, which seemed to be to the effect that you could consider a civil suit. He
sure
doesn't say that directly, but he certainly hints that
absolutely
would be
he hints that
approach.
Yep.
What I wanted to ask you was, as I view this case, it seems to me it's really, in essence, a supervisory writ case. It's a case where we have to look at what you've requested, a supervisory writ.
That's right.
In terms of the requirements.
Right.
And the requirement that the Court of Appeals found was lacking, and the one that I'd like you to address, is plain error.
Well, it's plain duty. And plain duty is conceded by Judge Finn in his brief as, if Judge Finn...
It's a failure to meet a plain duty or a plain error.
Right. And if Judge Finn had decided the refusal question based on an error of law, then it's a violation of his plain duty. So it's almost a circular argument. It takes us around and around the word refuses. If you interpret refuses to include a period of inactivity, then I don't meet the requirements of the supervisory writ and I lose. If you do define refuses to exclude a period of inactivity, then I win. So this is one of those cases where the standard of review is inexorably wrapped up with the legal question that you're going to have to resolve, which is, what does refuse mean? And everything else flows from that decision.
Well, but don't we also have to look then at whether or not there was an erroneous exercise of discretion by Judge Finn? Don't we have to give deference, in other words, to his ruling?
No, I don't believe you do, because it's a question of law. The question of law is, what does the word refuse mean? And if he's wrong, that's a de novo review in the Court of Appeals. It's also a de novo review here. And so it again takes us right back to the notion of, if he's wrong on refuse, then he's erroneously exercised his discretion under the case law that talks about that. So it all boils back down to, what does refuse mean? And everything flows from that. Yes, ma'am.
The issue might very well be that if there's inactivity for 2 weeks, it's not a refusal. If there's inactivity for 2 years,
maybe
it might be a refusal. Although, under both circumstances, the DA's office never says, we're not going to prosecute. It merely says, we're still investigating, or we're thinking about it, et cetera. Now, if the DA can stop a citizen from going to court and getting his or her own complaint, in a sense, filed, then the DA undermines this entire statute.
And I think it's at that point that's incumbent on the judge, Judge Finn in this case, to not let Mr. Hansen waffle.
And how do you do that?
You say, get Mr. Blanchard down here, and Mr. Blanchard, I want a yes or no answer. Are you going to prosecute or are you not going to prosecute? And if he says, I've sent this back to the police because I need more information, that's a legitimate exercise of prosecutorial discretion, which this review statute would not allow him to override. If he says, I'm not going to do it, then she's free to proceed. And if he says, no, I'm not.
How long can he investigate? There's no statute of limitations on murder.
That's right.
So he can do that for years and years.
And years and years. And that's.
You think that's within the meaning of the statute?
And that's what one of the problems in this case is, that there's a whole wide range of criminal behavior that's governed by statute. There's a lot of different statutes of limitations, some not at all, in homicides and now sexual assaults for all practical purposes. And so.
How do you want us to define refuse?
I want you to define refusal as an explicit refusal that I am not going to prosecute, just like Mr. McCann did in the...
Correct.
Well, I don't think that you could say ever. I think on the facts that I have them now, let's assume a completed investigation, because I think that's the first...
Explicit refuse today.
Pardon me?
An explicit refusal today when the DA appears in court.
I think on the filing of the complaint, the jurisdictional prerequisite before Judge Finn or any trial judge can go forward is to get an answer, hard answer to that question. And if the answer is I'm not ready to make that decision because we have an active investigation going on, which is what Mr. Blanchard said in his letter, we've sent it back to the police for more investigation. Pension fund cases are complicated. We can't just, you know, shoot from the hip here.
The judge do.
I think he says, under those circumstances, Ms. Chater, you have to wait until the police investigation is completed.
That may take years. We've decided that.
And it might.
And so doesn't the judge ever say, you are still investigating, time has run, the legislature intends that the complainant have an opportunity to bring the lawsuit, your explicit or your failure to say explicitly yes or no, we're going ahead anyway.
I think at some point perhaps a judge could draw that line if there was an evidentiary hearing where the police have said we've subpoenaed the records, we've interviewed all the witnesses, we really don't have anything further to do in this case. Our investigation is complete, and we've decided, let's just take your hypothetical, the police have decided we're not going to refer this for charges to the prosecutor. So the prosecutor doesn't have anything to base on other than what the complainant brings forward.
That's an easy one.
Well,
the one is, well, we got DNA evidence, it doesn't meet any cold hit, but sooner or later, the culprit's going to get into our database, and so we're not closing it.
Well, then you get into those John Doe warrant things that they do on genetic testing or DNA testing now, and that's a whole other question. But I think that it requires a more stringent inquiry as to the jurisdictional authority of the court than just to accept the complainant's bald assertion that the DA has refused, and especially when there's hard evidence out there that the case is still active. So I think I know you have to sort of test the limits, but I think that brings us to the next question, which is how do you decide what cases get what period of time of inactivity before it's okay for the judge to step in? And the two statutes that were so kindly cited to me by Judge Finn have different time periods, depending on the Section 19 statutes. I would think that it would be very difficult to draw a particular line of a particular period of inactivity for each criminal statute that a prosecutor might be called upon to.
Let's talk about this one, counsel.
Sure.
What's the statute? Are we looking at what, 6 years?
Here? 6 years on this particular charge.
So you and under your explanation or your reasoning, the district attorney could sit on this how long?
I don't think he could sit on it.
Well, okay.
I mean, that's the question. What's going on? I think that's the question that the judge has to ask to the district attorney.
Well, nothing's going on in this case, right?
Well,
we don't know.
On this record, we don't know what went on after Mr. Blanchard sent Ms. Chater's letter off to the Madison Police Department.
Certainly, if you look at the obvious, well, the intent of the statute is to do what? I'm talking about 968.023.
If you're to go back to unnamed defendant, what this court said about that statute is that it's a review statute. It's a judicial review statute of the district attorney's refusal to charge. And that's what Mr. McCann did in the original Connors decision. And that's what the district attorney, whose name now escapes me, did in the unnamed defendant decision. There was an explicit refusal. And they said, Judge, now you can review that.
We know this, that we're looking at something that happened 4 years ago, right?
2001.
Three years ago.
August 2001 was when the facts were alleged.
And we know that if 6 years goes by, that nothing can be done, right?
Right. This was 7 months, max.
So there'd have to be, I'm just looking at time, but the intent of the statute is allow a citizen to bring in a private action and if the district attorney doesn't do something.
That's correct.
And you want it just plain. He has to absolutely refuse. And here we had a hearing. We had Judge Finn look at everything. He talked to the defendant. He looked at he was able to discern what the district attorney had done through the assistant district attorney.
That's not correct. He didn't.
Okay, tell me.
He didn't have the letter.
He didn't have the letter. That's right. He did not have the letter.
He did not have the letter.
All right.
And so he didn't know, and he didn't inquire further of Mr. Blanchard. Mr. Hansen had no firsthand knowledge of what had gone on. He just showed up because he was sent down there to show up.
But the process you want is that at some point in time, depending on the case, enough is enough or inaction becomes a refusal if they don't act. That's what you're asking for. So each
no, I'm saying that in the first instance, that a trial judge, when faced with one of these private complaint petitions, has to pin the district attorney down. He has to say, tell me what's going on. And is this case still being actively investigated? Have you made a decision? If you've made a decision, tell me what your decision is.
So you want us to, if we decide that and write it, you want us to say that that's the district attorney has to be called in by the judge and say, all right, are you going to prosecute or not?
That's right.
Out, period.
That's got to be the first question out of the blocks, because the court has no jurisdiction to act otherwise.
Let me ask you, if I might, a question about the letter, because Justice Wilcox was just asking about that, and you were responding to it. There was a motion for reconsideration here.
That's right.
Did Judge Finn have the letter at
yes.
the time of that motion?
It was attached to the motion. And argued extensively in the briefs that were submitted to Judge Finn as to this letter and its contents. His written decision makes no mention of the letter. And as far as this record is concerned, there's no indication that he considered the letter or that he did anything with the contents of the letter. It's just in a list of what he considered in reaching his decision, the letter's not mentioned.
Isn't it reasonable to assume if it was attached to your motion that he considered the letter?
I could assume that he did, but I would think that it would at least warrant a mention in his written decision as to the matters that he considered in reaching his decision that the refusal was reasonable. And it's not there. He makes absolutely no mention of giving any consideration to the letter at all. And even in his brief in this court, which is the first brief that Judge Finn has filed at all, he just says there are multiple interpretations available to this letter. And he doesn't say, and I don't think he could say, even if he did, but he doesn't say, I considered it. So I think that it's one of those cases where there should have been a greater inquiry in the trial court or the hearing court or whatever you want to call it of the district attorney's office, and not just to accept Deputy District Attorney Hansen's representation that this is an ambiguous statute that could encompass a period of inactivity.
Counselor, I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
I want to go kind of back to the basics. My first question is, whose burden is it to show refusal?
I think it's the petitioner's burden to show refusal, and that it's a jurisdictional prerequisite for the court to establish refusal before anything else happens.
Okay, so forget the jurisdictional comment. So if you think it's the petitioner's burden, is refusal something that has to be shown as a factual matter, or is it a conclusional law for the court to make that there's been a refusal?
Well, I think it's the definition of the term is a conclusion of law for the court to make. The question is what's the factual showing, and if there's a dispute about the factual showing, how it gets resolved.
Right, and that's the point of my question about whose burden is it, because burden of proof tends to go to things that at least have some factual predicate.
Right.
Don't talk about burdens of proof with questions that are purely questions of law, correct?
Right. That's correct.
Okay, so your argument is that it was petitioner's burden of proof, and on this record, it's ambiguous about what was going to happen, so you can't have a refusal because we don't have the requisite factual predicate. Is that accurate?
The statute allows for the presence of the district attorney at this hearing.
Right.
They have to be given notice of the hearing by the petitioner. And I think that then provides at least sub silentio a notion that the prosecutor is going to come in and make a refusal declaration to the court.
Right.
And that's why Mr. Hansen was there. That's why he announced his presence there.
Right.
And when it became apparent, even after the hearing, that there was some dispute about that, it needed to get resolved.
Okay, but I want to go back to the hearing that occurred. Did the prosecutor ever represent that the district attorney's office had refused
no.
to prosecute?
No.
No,
he said,
not.
He said, what we have done is we haven't acted.
All right.
And that the statute encompasses inactivity, paraphrasing, and we think that you can find that we have refused based on our inactivity because this statute is ambiguous. That's what Mr. Hansen said.
Okay. Now, you said earlier in your discussions with us that Mr. Hansen showed up, as many ADAs do, because he was assigned this case, not because he knew anything about what the district attorney's office was doing investigation-wise on the claims of Ms. Tater. Is that in the record?
Well, I think if you read his very brief comments, which are in my brief, it's real clear that he wasn't clear as to what had gone on and who had said what and what had been discussed. And he didn't tender the letter. Ms. Tater never tendered the letter. She mentioned it in her testimony later on in the hearing. I inferred from Mr. Hansen's comments that he had no firsthand knowledge about what had gone on, that he was just looking at a file or was being told or was paraphrasing what Ms. Tater put in her motion. I don't know, but he did not represent to the court that he had been involved in that decision personally and that it was his decision as the assigned district attorney. He clearly referenced what Mr. Blanchard had done and the fact that there had been this meeting and in sort of sketching out the procedural history.
All right. Thank you.
Sure.
What needed to be investigated further in order to conduct a prosecution?
I have no idea. That's not my call. I feel it's sort of a disadvantage here arguing on behalf of law enforcement and prosecutors as a criminal defense lawyer. That's a discretionary call that we trust to prosecutors. He says in his letter to Ms. Chater, misapplication of pension fund cases are difficult to prove. So I don't think it's unreasonable at all for him to send this back to the police department and not just accept a bunch of documents from a disgruntled former employee who says, I want you to get this guy. I think that there's more to these kinds of cases than just, 15 pages of documents.
Counsel, you say you're a defense attorney?
That's correct.
Do you ever handle cases involving operating under the influence?
Certainly.
Familiar with the refusal law?
Sure.
Does there have to be an explicit statement that I will not take a chemical test in order to constitute a refusal?
No. As I ever recall of refusal cases, if somebody doesn't blow an adequate breath sample, for example, if they go and blow out of the side of their mouth, the cop says, no, you got to blow into the tube. And if you don't blow into the tube, I'm going to count it as a refusal. So certainly behavior or conduct can constitute a refusal in the refusal cases. And I think that's been upheld before on many occasions. That's the Candler case, if you will, which was the Medicaid divestment case that was cited in the state's brief, where there's a conscious decision to omit a particular asset in your medical assistance application, then you've divested and now you're eligible for Medicare. That's a conscious decision. I'm not going to do something. And I think that at some point a judge may be called upon to make that call on a prosecutor. But first he's at least got to ask the question, what are you doing with this case? If this is a judicial review of a prosecutor's discretion statute, which is what I think it is and what unnamed defendant says it is, then you have to do a meaningful review of the exercise of discretion. And that wasn't done in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Fink. Your time. time is up, and you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you. Anthony A. Tomaselli, representing the respondents, the Circuit Court for Dane County, and the Honorable John Finn. Now, I see Mr. Rice is at council table, but you're scheduled for all 30 minutes, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I would pin that higher up on your lapel, counsel. Thank you.
State of Wisconsin by Anthony Tomaselli of Quarles and Brady, the Circuit Court for Dane County, and the Honorable John V. Finn by David Rice, Assistant Attorney General. Justice Prosser, you took my example. I think you're absolutely right. With respect to the word refusal, we have Circuit Court judge use statutes that have those terms in them every day, and the refusal can be an express refusal or an implied refusal through an action or through game plan. That is done every day, and it's left to the discretion of the Circuit Court to make that determination of what a refusal is, given the facts and circumstances underlying the activity in question. Now, I think it's important that we examine the procedural posture of this case. We're here on their motion, and their motion is a petition for a supervisory writ. In their petition, they claim that the Dane County District Attorney had not, in fact, refused to prosecute as required by Section 968.023. In order for them to prevail on their motion, they must demonstrate four elements. The first, that an appeal is an inadequate remedy. They have demonstrated that. Prior case law indicates that there is no appeal from such a determination. The request for a supervisory writ is made promptly and speedily. We can see that they did that. The third is that grave hardship or irreparable harm will result from the denial of the writ. I do not concede that, and I do not believe that they have shown that. And the fourth factor is that the Circuit Court acted in violation of a plain duty. Again, I do not concede that.
Counselor, do you agree with your opponent that if the Circuit Court wrongly interpreted the statute at issue, that it violated a plain legal duty?
I don't go that far, Your Honor. And there's been some confusion, I think, in the briefs with respect to the appropriate review here. With respect to the underlying factual determinations by Judge Finn, I think that's subject to the clearly erroneous standard. And it's important also, I think, and this is a related topic, that the statute does not allow for cross-examination and is an ex parte proceeding. And so it is certainly our argument, and we argued this below, that Mr. Blanchard's letter is not part of Judge Finn's consideration, is not part of the review, because it was not before him when he made his determination. And so if, for example, the petitioners didn't have the right for cross-examination, they certainly don't have the right later to bring in further additional evidence which they believe supports their position. So with respect to the underlying factual determination, subject to the clearly erroneous standard based on the facts that were produced at that hearing. And that is what we're here to discuss, is what was produced at that hearing, in our opinion.
So if I understand your argument is that all that has to be done by the petitioner is to establish a prima facie case for refusal. And that's sufficient because there's no cross-examination by what might have been done that might not then be looked at as a refusal. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And with respect to the legal interpretation of the word refuses in the statute, I do believe that that's a legal conclusion that is subject to de novo review.
Thank you.
Let me just follow up on that. It's your position with regard to establishing the refusal. What is the burden on the petitioner?
And we're not talking about the petitioners in this appellate procedure. We're talking about the party that actually filed the complaint.
That? Yes, thank you.
I don't know if the burden is really on the complainant. I think that the reason that the district attorney is there is the district attorney is there to say whether or not they're going to prosecute. And if the district attorney does not demonstrate to the court that they're not going to prosecute, the judge should feel free to go forward. In this particular instance, Deputy District Attorney Hansen is a skilled advocate. If he, for the moment, thought that his office wanted to prosecute this matter, he would have told the judge expressly that they intended to prosecute. He did not do that. In fact, he conceded, in my opinion, that they were free to go forward because he stated, "I don't think our office ever affirmatively stated we would not prosecute. What we have done is failed to do so. So I think a fair reading of refusal in the statutes encompasses both of the situations." So the district attorney in that instance was there to say whether or not they intended to proceed. And if they intended to proceed, if they wanted additional time to investigate, if they were hopeful that the Madison Police Department was going to do anything about this matter, that's when Deputy District Attorney Hansen could have told the court that, and he didn't.
Let's take the kind of situation that this may or may not be, but let me address this hypothetical as a period of inactivity, 3 years. And the complainant wants prosecution to ensue. Who has the question? If it isn't explicit, then we have to in some way interpret refusal from the circumstances. Who has the burden of showing that the circumstances as they add up would compel the court to make a factual determination that this is a refusal?
In the posture of this,
that this meets the legal standard of whatever a refusal is, and let's say it's not explicit.
In the posture of this proceeding before you, the petitioners have the burden to demonstrate there was insufficient evidence, because what they have to show here, and that's why I reverted back to the procedural posture, they have to show a violation of a plain duty. So I think in having to carry that burden, then it goes back to showing the underlying facts are insufficient and that the judge didn't have enough to do what he did. And so I think we're struggling with, if we were just looking at the underlying hearing, we might think that there's a different burden of proof with respect to the facts and who's the moving party. But I think that burden is not applicable any longer because of the procedural posture here and the fact that the petitioners now have to show that Judge Finn violated a plain duty. Now,
if I may, trying to build on what your opposing counsel argued, if you were not to prevail here, wouldn't the remedy be a new hearing in front of Judge Flynn, in which he simply asked Mr. Blanchard, "Are you going to prosecute?"
Absolutely. If we're not to win today, I think it should be remanded for a hearing before Judge Finn on that issue. I don't think it's necessary for all the reasons we've said in our brief, and I'll say it in my own argument.
Is there any evidence that the investigation is still going on, or that this is being weighed by the district attorney's office?
Well, I hesitate, Your Honor, because of record and not of record. With respect to the record, there is nothing that indicates one way or the other. I obviously, since I am the special prosecutor, have knowledge of the case, but it's not of record.
Well, there's nothing in the record to show any activity, investigative activity.
Correct. And, in fact, all the evidence by the complaining witness, Michelle Chater, was otherwise.
What's otherwise?
She indicated that she had referred the matter to the police department, that it was her understanding they hadn't taken any action, and in fact, in the transcript, I think there's a reference to that they hadn't since November even returned her calls.
So What's the inference, the reasonable inference from this record?
The reasonable inference is that the district attorney refused to issue
reasonable
a complaint.
Reasonable inference is nothing is going on. That's the first inference.
Absolutely.
And explicitly, the DA hasn't said aye and he hasn't said nay. He hasn't said I'm not prosecuting. And he hasn't said I will prosecute. He said nothing.
No,
other than, there it is.
I would disagree with that characterization. Under these facts, I believe the district attorney went much further, and Deputy District Attorney Hansen indicated, Judge, as I read this statute, you may read our inactivity as a refusal.
Well, that's the lawyer's interpretation of the statute. That's not evidentiary. The point of this is to find out what the DA's office is or is not doing, right?
Correct.
And they didn't say they're refusing, and they didn't say they're actively doing it. They're saying to the judge, you may infer from our inactivity that it is a refusal. Isn't that what he's saying?
Yes, he is saying that.
Is that good enough?
That's not what we have, though. We have more. We have Michelle Chater's testimony, which is undisputed, as it has to be in the context of this hearing, because there's no cross-examine and ex parte. We have her, we have the timing, and we have her saying that she received, and this is her testimony, she received a letter from the district attorney that informed her that they weren't doing anything with it at that time, and she was free to proceed in whatever manner she thought appropriate. And that's at the transcript in petitioner's appendix at page 150, 151. We have her testimony that she was under the impression that the matter was closed and that she had an invitation to do what she felt needed to be done. That is her testimony. That's not contradicted at that hearing, as it couldn't be. And that's petitioner's appendix, page 151. So, with respect to this case, we have more than just those statements in your hypothetical about the district attorney.
So the judge can draw as a fact, from a reasonable inference from these facts, that the DA is refusing to prosecute. That's your position.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in fact, if Deputy District Attorney Hansen wanted to prosecute this case, he would have said so at the hearing, and he did not.
Is there anything to prevent the district attorney's office from being a party to these proceedings? I mean, we have the judge represented. We have, you're representing, in effect, the petitioner, complainant? Who are you representing?
I represent the state of Wisconsin.
You represent the state of Wisconsin.
And I am appointed counsel to be the state of Wisconsin's attorney in the prosecution, if there's going to be one, against the petitioners.
You're not representing the district attorney's office, though. Or are you?
No, I'm not representing the Dane County District Attorney's Office.
If the DA wanted, as a follow-up, if the DA wanted to be present and argue, no, I really didn't refuse, I don't want this complaint filed, would he have, was she of standing? The DA could have said, look, I'm not prosecuting now. It's an open case. I don't, as Mr. Fink said, I want more time. The cops want more time. Don't do it, Judge. And the judge says, we're doing it. So it would be adversary, and you would be representing the county and Finn and where does the DA get a shot? Mr. Fink would still have his position.
Procedurally, I don't believe that there is an avenue for the district attorney to be a party, but I submit that it would be easy for the district attorney to appear in the Court of Appeals and in this court as a friend of the court in I don't want to be presumptuous and say what any court would do, but I would think that they'd welcome the input from the attorney or from the district attorney. Now, we had the opportunity in the context of the motion for reconsideration to bring forward additional evidence if we wanted to with respect to the district attorney's position. We made a choice, and the choice was that that would be inappropriate for all the reasons I said before, because what we're looking at and what Judge Finn was doing was looking at the evidence that was adduced at that hearing, and the evidence that was adduced at that hearing was sufficient to allow him to proceed under 968.023.
Counsel, why are we looking at the wrong word? We're looking at the word refusal. Why aren't we looking at the word plain? This procedural posture is the fourth element of a supervisory writ, is that the duty has to be so plain. Well, I'm not sure it's so plain here. I mean, what have we been talking about if it's so plain? And if we are fighting on a interpretation of a statute that is leaves to us how you define the word refuse, and if the definition of refusal is that it can be constructive refusal, then we have to determine if there's sufficient evidence to meet the legal standard of a constructive refusal. I mean, isn't plain duty the kind of duty that is so clear that it leaves nothing to discretion? And boy, you got a lot of discretion going on here.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor. And one thing I think that the court was concerned about in unnamed parties versus O'Brien was this is precisely the type of thing that we want to we don't want to get involved in, the courts don't want to get involved in. We don't want John Doe proceedings or proceedings under 968.023 to have all these petitions questioning this and questioning that. So the standard for a supervisory writ is extraordinary.
Yeah, I think we're arguably being led down a path where any time there's a question of statutory interpretation, and then if you get to answer it in a certain way, it's sufficiency of the evidence that can form the basis for coming in on a supervisory writ. I mean, I just don't know why we're arguing some of the... I'm sure there's a good answer. But I don't know why we're arguing all this stuff that isn't so clear. Is there sufficiency of evidence? And you know, is it explicit or is it constructive, implicit? I mean, is there set forth a clear and plain duty, so clear and so plain that it leaves nothing for discretion?
No, there isn't.
Now, having said that, is that the definition of plain, clear and plain duty?
We were not able to find much case law at all on that precise issue, on what exactly that element of a supervisory writ is all about.
I'm borrowing from ministerial duty, because what is a ministerial duty? You know, it's so clear and plain it leaves nothing for discretion. I'm paraphrasing, and but that's why I'm saying our focus is maybe on the wrong thing. I don't know.
And one ironic factor that's going on here is because we are here today under 968.023, there's more ability given the case law that allows a supervisory writ in this context, than there would be in the normal course. The normal course is the district attorney signs the complaint, and then we go to the preliminary hearing. Well, we haven't even gotten to the preliminary hearing yet because of all this procedural maneuvering, given the fact that we're under 968.02, and a circuit judge happened to be involved in the process versus the district attorney.
What is the procedural status of the complaint that was ordered filed?
The complaint has not, in fact, been filed, and I have not issued a summons on the complaint yet.
It's been given a case number, right?
Yes, but it's an odd case number. It's one that I'm not familiar with.
But how does it exist in the record, then, as an unfiled complaint that has been ordered filed?
Correct. And it's not been filed, however, as a factual matter.
Okay. To follow up on Justice Bradley's question, as I read the statute, the discretionary part of the statute pertains to the judge's decision whether or not to permit the filing of the private complaint. But arguably, there is a duty on the part of the judge to ascertain whether there has been the requisite refusal or unavailability on the part of the DA. Is that a fair interpretation of the statute?
I think the ultimate determination of the judge is a discretionary determination.
On both parts?
With respect to the first two parts, I will agree that your characterization of it is correct.
So the judge has that duty to ascertain whether that threshold prerequisite has been met, and if he did so on the basis of an incorrect legal standard, that would be the violation of the plain duty for purposes of the supervisory writ action.
I mean, that's certainly what the petitioners argue, and that's how they get to the point where there is a violation of a plain duty.
How do you work that, for counsel? If the judge has a plain duty to ascertain from the DA, and the DA says, well, Judge, I'm not going to today because we're not ready. We've got further investigation, and 3 years later the judge checks up, and, boy, Judge, we're still investigating. Then how does that tie into the duty of the judge?
Well, I don't think there was a violation of plain duty, and part of that analysis is the fact that refusal has to encompass not only express refusals and inactivity. If it did not, then a district attorney could nullify the statute. The history behind the statute is that it is enacted to provide a check upon the district attorney's decision not to prosecute, and to also protect victims' rights in the state of Wisconsin. And if we did not allow the circuit court judge to make a determination, not only when there was an express refusal, but also if, based on all the facts and circumstances at the hearing, that there was inactivity sufficient or indications from a deputy district attorney, for example, that they could characterize their inactivity as a refusal. Circuit court judges have to be empowered in order to effectuate the statute to go forward.
Counselor, in response to Justice Sykes' question about the status of the case, you said that a complaint has not been filed, so the one that Ms. Tater filed or really proposed has not been filed to commence an action. And if an action is to go forward, will you be the one that's going to file a complaint, or will Ms. Tater be filing the complaint?
The judge has ordered it to be filed, and this is not in the record, but the court clerk's office didn't know how to proceed, and they asked for guidance. And what would happen is if the special prosecutor decides to proceed in this matter, then a summons would be issued and the complaint would be filed. And that's another point that I think needs to be made. We're focusing solely here on the power to accuse or initiate a criminal proceeding. It is back now into the prosecutor's hands as to whether or not this matter will go forward. With respect to the hypothetical that was posed at the start of opposing counsel's argument, the special prosecutor appointed in that instance will hopefully exercise appropriate discretion and decide, well, maybe now is not the time to proceed. Maybe we should wait until that defendant or proposed defendant slips up. So the prosecution still has all the discretion as to whether to go forward or not in this matter.
But, you know, that brings me to something that it's really kind of off the track, but it kind of bothers me about this case, is that, in my view, only the state can bring forth the state's power in the form of a criminal action, yet the judge ordered someone who is not
an agent of the state in the district attorney's office to file the complaint. And that's kind of why I was curious about, well, if it goes forward, who does it? Do we have a problem if she does it, or are, if you decide to do it, are you going to use her complaint or draft one of your own? I guess I'm just kind of curious about how you see that working.
Right now, the judge has ordered that her complaint, which is in the file and is signed by her and notarized by the court, would be filed, but the special prosecutor would retain, as any prosecutor would, the ability to amend the complaint and the ability to dismiss the complaint if appropriate.
I see. Okay, thanks. That helps a lot.
So you have the authority as special prosecutor to countermand the judge's order that this complaint be filed and refuse in the exercise of discretion to actually file it?
No, I believe that procedurally it would have to be filed, but I believe that I still have the ability to dismiss the filed complaint.
But the complaint will be filed.
The judge has ordered the complaint to be filed.
Right, and that's irrevocable right now.
Absolutely.
So the accusation will be made, and the defendant's brought before the court, and you may, at the initial appearance, move to dismiss in the exercise of your prosecutorial discretion, but nevertheless, that much harm will have been done.
The complaint will be filed. I believe another step has to take place, and that is the issuance of a warrant or a summons. So that, I don't believe the judge has ordered to happen, and that, I believe, is left to my discretion.
So you could go in ex parte and move to dismiss the complaint without summoning the defendants?
I think procedurally that's possible. I don't know if I would do that, but I think procedurally, as I understand it, that's possible.
Does the trial court have any discretion in dismissing?
Yes.
Okay. So the judge's duty here is to make a decision. Is that the duty we're talking about? Got to decide this case.
The judge has to decide the petition that was presented to the judge.
And that's the plain duty. I want to know what the plain duty is. Justice Sykes said it's the duty to ascertain the refusal of the DA. Well, okay, you can say DA yes, DA no, but the ultimate decision is whether to have this complaint filed, right?
Yes.
And deciding whether it's ascertaining whether it's a refusal depends on how you define the statute. It's a question of law, right?
Yes.
And you're urging that the judge decide it implicit, that is, it can be inferred from behavior as well as explicit, right?
Yes.
And is that a finding of fact if he infers it from behavior?
Yes.
All right. And then, once you find the facts, then it's whether they fill that statute, right?
Correct.
That's a question of law.
As this court has defined it, yes.
Okay. So, at what point is it a violation of plain duty? Is it when the judge makes an error of law in defining refuse? Is it when the judge makes a mistake of fact on whether these facts constitute implicit? Or was it when the judge applies the legal analysis to these facts? Or is your answer none of the above?
Well, my answer, and I'll try to answer your question, but my first response is that that's the job of the petitioners to tell us what plain duty was violated by the circuit court judge. And I submit that they haven't done that.
Counsel, your opposing counsel defined plain duty in his earlier comments. He said plain duty, if the court defines refuses incorrectly, that's a violation of plain duty. If he's wrong on the law, then he has violated his plain duty.
That's why I laid it out the way I laid it out.
So is that the plain duty? Do you agree that's the plain duty? Or is the plain duty that he's got to get a decision from the DA? Or what is meant by plain duty under our supervisory writ jurisprudence. Is it, as he advanced in his earlier comments, that it is a plain duty essentially to get the law right?
I do not believe that a misinterpretation of the law in and of itself would be a plain duty, as I understand the factors on the first supervisory writ. It certainly could in some instances, but I will not concede that in and of itself is a violation of a plain duty.
I understand that this statute has been upheld against constitutional challenge, and so it is a constitutional challenge. It doesn't violate separation of powers, but I think you'd have to admit that there is a constitutional tension between this statute and the prosecutorial discretion, the discretion that rests in the prosecutor's power. Does that tension, do you think, call for a stricter interpretation of the meaning of refuses?
No, I think it calls for exactly the opposite, because I don't think there's a tension, because we have to focus on what the stage is that we're talking about. And the stage is the power to accuse, and it's not the power to later prosecute. And as all these cases dealing with this subject have traced, with the exception of the Connors decision, that is a judicial power. It is a judicial power. And so actually we should interpret narrowly the grant to the district attorney, and I think it fully supports, and given that history that's set forth in Unnamed Defendant, that the power for the judicial branch to accuse is quite broad and historically has been quite broad. And so if anything, we should allow the word refuses to be broadly interpreted given that historical context.
Counsel, which of these cases that you cite in the briefs or that opposing counsel cites deals with the plain duty of a court rather than the plain duty of an executive officer?
You know what I'm talking about?
I don't, Your Honor.
Well, my just occurred to me, and so I can't sort out the cases well enough. And maybe you can't either this quickly. But generally, when we talk about plain duty, isn't it of some officer, not the court's plain duty, but an officer's plain duty that he has to do this, that, or the other thing, and so you bring a supervisory writ like mandamus or prohibition, and we're reviewing that officer. We're not reviewing the court. Now, as I say, I may have jumbled this in my mind, and I may be just absolutely wrong, but this is why I think we're having so much trouble as to what the court's duty is.
And I believe that the case law that's out there is exactly as you have articulated it, and this harkens back to my earlier comment. We didn't find anything really that spoke of this element in the context of a supervisory writ to a court.
How about the judge? Substitution cases where a judge declines to accept a substitution that's been filed on that judge, and that is challenged on a supervisory writ in the Court of Appeals? Mm-hmm. I think that would be the most closely analogous. Did you take a look at any of those?
And in that context, I'm not by any means an expert in those cases, but I think in that context that it is a supervisory writ, and it would have been focused on plain duty, but I don't think there's...
Statutory duty of the judge that has a certain, you know, set of terminology and prerequisites, and if those are met, the judge has the statutory duty, and it's reviewable by way of supervisory writ action in the Court of Appeals.
Yes,
typically.
There the judge is acting administratively, whether he sits or she sits or not. Not deciding a case. So I totally agree about the substitution. But it's the judge there looks like an executive an officer. And they have a duty under the law, and did they exercise that duty? So
I mean, there may be cases, I don't know, I'm just trying to parse this out. We're having trouble explaining what the court's duty is. The court's duty is always to decide cases. The duty is to decide them correctly. But I don't know how that fits under supervisory writ, Justice Crooks.
Mr. Tomaselli, let me just ask you, because I think this touches on what both of the justices have been asking you. Isn't there a distinction here between a court and a circuit judge? In
yes.
other words, aren't we looking at the plain duty of a circuit judge here rather than a court?
Yes.
Did you find any discussion of that in the cases you were looking at in regard to plain duty?
No, Your Honor. There's only discussion of that fact with respect to appeals and writs and the distinction between acting as a court and the right for a direct appeal, which we don't have in this instance.
The John Doe type of situation.
Correct. But nothing in that context relating to that topic.
Thank you.
Mr. Frick.
Thank you, sir.
I want to address an issue that was raised by Justice Prosser in the refusal analogy in the OWI cases and whether we have the implicit versus express refusal. And to echo a comment I think that you raised about that to Justice Sykes. The OWI refusal case is different because you're evaluating the actions of a defendant who's before the court. What we're talking about here is judicial taking over of a prosecutorial function. And I think that before that threshold can be crossed, because of the separation of powers concern, there has to be something more than the blowing up the side of the mouth in the refusal cases in an OWI situation. Because judges are then arrogating a prosecutorial function defined by statute. I mean, if you go back to 968.02 sub 2, I believe, it says the only person who can file a criminal complaint is a district attorney, not a judge. And it's only if you have two specific exceptions can a judge step in and take over that power. So the legislature has defined the power. It's not historical antecedents anymore that was discussed an unnamed defendant as to judges in the 1930s being able to issue complaints. We have the legislature in 1969, when they redid the criminal code, defined what the boundaries are. They staked it out and said DAs get to issue criminal charges. And only under these specific circumstances, and that takes me back to State X. Rel. Unnamed Petitioner versus the Circuit Court of Walworth County at 157 with Second 157, which is cited in my brief, where they imposed a stricter application of this statute on the judge and said, in order to avoid these separation of powers problems, we need to have specific application of this statute. Judge Finn, I'm sorry.
Let me interrupt. Did you find any case law in regard to the idea of plain duty as it would relate to a circuit judge? Can you point us to any cases?
I cannot point you to any case that makes that distinction as to when a court of appeals is reviewing the action of a judge as opposed to reviewing the action of a highway commissioner. I don't think it makes a difference. I think whoever the decision maker is, if the plain duty is violated, then the plain duty is violated. And if the decision maker happens to be a circuit court judge in misinterpreting the law, it's my position that that's a violation of plain duty entitlement to the writ.
You know how it usually comes up with a circuit court is that there's a motion to enjoin or stay here. So you don't like the trial to proceed. You bring a writ here, a prohibition, or you seek an injunction. You know, writ practice is all over the map, and whatever you call it, it's an extraordinary kind of remedy. But
we don't usually get into plain duty there. We get into what are the chances of your winning,
right,
ultimately, that kind of thing. That's why I was so bothered by this discussion.
The problem we have here is, I think it was recognized in Unnamed Defendant, and that these cases are so unique and they're so infrequent that you're not going to get a chance to define this word refuse if you don't take it in this case. And I think that's an important distinction. And I want to just sort of...
I haven't thought this one through either, and I apologize to you. But the reason we're getting into this writ problem is because of the Court of Appeals saying that they wouldn't have granted leave to appeal, isn't it?
No, we didn't. I didn't bring it up that way. I had recognized under Gavagas v. Maroney that I had no right of direct appeal. Having no right of direct appeal, I can't petition for leave to appeal. The only thing left is mandamus or a supervisory writ, and I know that those have all been sort of jumbled together.
That's why I'm saying this.
And so my only way of getting up here is by way of supervisory writ, and I think that this Court didn't take this case to decide what plain duty was. I think the Court took the case, if I may be so presumptuous, is to struggle with the refusal. That's the issue that's, I think, the important one that's going to have the statewide impact. And finally, just before I close, I want to address the issue of remedy that you brought up, Justice Prosser. I think the remedy here is a dismissal because the original authority of the Court to act was not established. And I think that the case has to go back to square one. If Michelle Chater wants to file another motion for private criminal complaint, she can do that. And then it would be incumbent on whatever judge is assigned to inquire of the prosecutor, either Mr. Tomaselli or if he's still around, or Mr. Blanchard, what the status of things are. But I don't think that we go back and get another kick at the cat with respect to saying to Mr. Blanchard, who hasn't been involved in this case since Mr. Tomaselli was appointed, what are you going to do? So I think that that's my view of what the appropriate remedy is that just the case should be dismissed because the private filing disallowed and Mr. Tomaselli discharged.
Mr. Tomaselli's authority doesn't continue. His authority is extinguished if the case is dismissed.
That's correct. That would be my view. Thank you very much.
Also, thank you both to both counsel, Tomaselli and Mr. Frick, for their arguments today. And that closes the hearing on 02-2490-W, Halo versus Circuit Court for Dane County. The students may remain here and will be joined by other students. Anyone who wishes to attend this session on the procedures of the court is welcome to do so. Justice Prosser will be out momentarily.